A sloth, a donkey, and a curious human. Send a prompt and see what they're doing. One hits a record with a question on his mind. Two brothers pick it up, see what they find. Corn takes his time, Herman's got the facts. Back and forth, they never hold back. My weird prompts, come on in, that's where we begin. My weird prompts, glad you're here.
This episode was generated using artificial intelligence. Please verify facts.
I've done the 24-hour ambulatory blood pressure monitor, and I'll say this. It's the only medical test where the machine seems personally offended by your existence. Every 20 minutes during the day, every 30 minutes at night, this cuff clamped around your arm inflates without warning. You'll be mid-sentence in the meeting, and suddenly your arm is being squeezed like an overripe fruit. Then, at 2 in the morning, just as you've finally drifted off, the motor whirs to life and reminds you that sleep is for people with cooperative arteries.
The bruising is real. I had patients come back after a 24-hour halter looking like they'd lost an argument with an octopus. Little circular hematomas up and down the arm where the cuff bit in.
Yet that miserable device tells you something a single office reading never will. Blood pressure isn't one number. It's a 24-hour story with peaks and valleys. A narrative that changes while you're arguing with traffic, while you're asleep, while you're just sitting there wondering why you agreed to wear this thing. And for the 1.28 billion people worldwide living with hypertension, that story is intimately tied to two fist-sized organs most of us never think about until they stop working.
They're the quiet architects of blood pressure regulation, and they take a beating from hypertension long before anything shows up on standard blood work. It's a bidirectional relationship that most people don't discover until one direction has already done significant damage.
Daniel sent us this one. He's been through the 24-hour halter himself, and he's asking the practical questions that come after. If you have hypertension, how often do you actually need to monitor at home? What's the real connection between blood pressure and kidney health? And where does gout fit into that picture? Because apparently uric acid is doing more than just tormenting your big toe. And for someone who wants to stay vigilant without becoming the person who takes their blood pressure cuff on vacation, what are the common sense recommendations?
These are exactly the right questions. And the gout angle is one of those connections that clinical practice is only recently taking seriously. It's not just about joint pain anymore.
Today we're untangling the kidney blood pressure loop, the gout connection that nobody talks about at dinner parties, and how to monitor your blood pressure at home without letting the cuff become your entire personality.
Let's lay out the basic architecture here, because the kidney blood pressure relationship is one of those physiological loops that's almost elegant in its cruelty. High blood pressure damages the kidneys. Damaged kidneys drive blood pressure higher, and around it goes.
A feedback loop with no off switch.
Exactly the problem. The tiny blood vessels inside the nephrons, these are the kidney's filtration units. They're exposed to your full systemic pressure. Over years, that pressure causes the vessel walls to thicken and scar, a process called arteriolar nephrosclerosis. As those vessels narrow, the glomeruli, the actual filter clusters, start getting less blood flow, and their filtration rate drops.
Silently is the operative word here. Because standard blood tests won't catch this until you've already lost something like half your kidney function. That's the part that always gets me. You can feel completely fine while the damage is accumulating.
Creatinine doesn't rise meaningfully in the blood until the glomerular filtration rate has dropped by roughly 50%. That's why hypertension is the second leading cause of kidney failure after diabetes, and why anyone with hypertension needs to think about kidney health even when their labs come back normal. The labs are a lagging indicator.
Then the kidneys get their revenge. Once they're damaged, they lose their ability to regulate the renin-angiotensin-aldosterone system properly. They overproduce renin, which triggers a cascade of vasoconstriction and sodium retention that pushes blood pressure even higher. The organ that was victimized becomes the aggressor.
That's the bidirectional part Daniel was asking about. It's not just that hypertension hurts kidneys. Damaged kidneys actively worsen hypertension, a self-reinforcing spiral.
Which brings us to gout, of all things. Most people think of it as the stuff that crystallizes in your big toe and makes you regret every steak you ever ate. but uric acid is filtered out by the kidneys, and when kidney function declines, uric acid builds up. So gout can be secondary to kidney disease. That's the straightforward direction.
The emerging picture is that it goes the other way too. High uric acid itself appears to damage kidneys and raise blood pressure independently. Uric acid crystals can deposit in the renal tubules, causing inflammation and fibrosis. It also inhibits nitric oxide production in blood vessels, which impairs vasodilation. So you get this three-way triangle. Blood pressure damages kidneys. Damaged kidneys raise uric acid. High uric acid further damages kidneys and raises blood pressure.
A love triangle where nobody's happy.
A miserable throuple, yes. And it means that treating gout isn't just about joint pain anymore. It may be a kidney protective and blood pressure lowering intervention. That's a clinical conversation that's only really gained traction in the last few years.
Let's get into the mechanics. How exactly does high blood pressure physically damage kidney tissue?
Picture each nephron as a tiny coffee filter. Blood comes in through the afferent arteriole, that's the vessel feeding the filter, and hits the glomerulus, which is the filter paper itself. In a healthy kidney, that filter sees pressure of maybe 60 millimeters of mercury, but in someone with uncontrolled hypertension, it's getting hammered with systemic pressure that might be double that. Over time, the filter paper basically gets blown out.
High pressure shreds the mesh.
That's the image. The technical term is glomerular hypertension and hyperfiltration. At first, the increased pressure actually forces more filtrate through, which sounds good but isn't. It damages the filtration barrier, and proteins start leaking through where they shouldn't. The kidney responds by scarring over the damaged areas. That's the sclerosis part of arteriolar nephrosclerosis. But scar tissue doesn't filter. So you lose functional nephrons one by one, silently, for years.
Because you've got about 1 million nephrons per kidney, you can lose a staggering number before anyone notices. The surviving nephrons just work harder to compensate.
That's why creatinine, the waste product everyone tracks on their blood work, stays stubbornly normal until you've lost roughly half your filtration capacity. The remaining nephrons pick up the slack. It's a remarkable compensatory mechanism that also happens to mask a slow-moving catastrophe.
The kidneys are absorbing damage in silence, and then they start fighting back. That's the renin-angiotensin-aldosterone cascade you mentioned.
This is where the spiral really tightens. Damaged kidneys sense reduced blood flow and respond exactly the wrong way. They release excess renin as if the problem were low blood pressure. Renin converts angiotensinogen to angiotensin 1, which becomes angiotensin 2, which is one of the most potent vasoconstrictors in the human body. At the same time, angiotensin 2 triggers aldosterone release, which makes you retain sodium and water. More fluid in the pipes, tighter pipes, higher pressure. The kidneys just misread the entire situation and pour gasoline on the fire.
The organ that's being destroyed by high pressure is simultaneously ordering the body to raise the pressure even more. That's a design flaw.
It's a system that evolved for surviving hemorrhage and dehydration, not for coping with decades of hypertension in a modern body. The feedback loop assumes low pressure is the threat. It has no programming for chronic high pressure.
Which brings us back to uric acid, because it turns out this third player makes everything worse. You mentioned the three-way triangle earlier. Let's put some numbers on that.
There was a meta-analysis published in the American Journal of Kidney Diseases in 2024 that looked at urate-lowering therapy in patients with both gout and chronic kidney disease. The results were striking. They found roughly a 5 millimeter of mercury reduction in systolic blood pressure and a slower decline in kidney function by about 3 milliliters per minute per 1.73 meters squared over 12 months. That's not a massive effect, but it's clinically meaningful and it's independent of other blood pressure medications.
Treating gout with something like allopurinol isn't just about silencing an angry toe joint. It's potentially preserving kidney function and nudging down blood pressure at the same time.
And the mechanism makes sense when you look at what uric acid does inside the kidney. It can form microcrystals in the renal tubules that trigger inflammation and eventual fibrosis. It also suppresses nitric oxide production in the endothelial cells lining your blood vessels. Nitric oxide is the signal that tells vessels to relax and dilate. When that signal gets muted, vessels stay constricted and blood pressure climbs.
Gout becomes both a consequence and a cause. The kidneys fail to clear uric acid, so gout develops. But then the elevated uric acid further damages the kidneys and stiffens the blood vessels, another bidirectional loop nested inside the first one.
That's the clinical shift that's been happening. Historically, gout was treated as a rheumatologic problem. Painful joints, manage the flares, move on. But the evidence is now strong enough that nephrologists and cardiologists are paying attention. If a patient walks in with hypertension and gout, the urate-lowering therapy conversation isn't optional anymore. It's part of the blood pressure and kidney protection strategy.
All from a waste product most people only think about when they can't put on a shoe.
We've seen how this vicious cycle works. The obvious question is, how do you keep an eye on it without living in fear of the cuff?
Daniel's been through the 24-hour Holter. He knows exactly how miserable that experience is. So the practical question is, when do you actually need to submit to that thing? And when is home monitoring enough?
The 24-hour ambulatory monitor is the gold standard for a reason. It catches three things that office readings miss entirely. White coat hypertension, where your pressure spikes the moment you walk into a clinic but is normal the rest of the day. Masked hypertension, the opposite, normal in the office but elevated everywhere else. And nocturnal hypertension, pressure that stays high while you sleep, which is particularly damaging to kidneys.
That last one is the sneaky one. You can have perfect daytime numbers and still be wrecking your kidneys at night.
You never know without the Holter. The American Heart Association recommends ambulatory monitoring specifically for confirming a hypertension diagnosis before starting medication. It's not intended for routine follow-up in most cases. If you've already been diagnosed and you're on a stable medication regimen, the Holter is usually overkill.
The Holter is a diagnostic tool, not a lifestyle.
One miserable day to establish what you're actually dealing with, then you switch to home monitoring for the long haul.
Which raises the question, what does home monitoring actually look like if you're doing it right? Because I've seen people check their blood pressure while talking on the phone, while crossing their legs, while the cuff is sliding down their forearm. The number they get is basically fiction.
The protocol matters more than most people realize. The AHA recommendation is specific for a reason. Sit quietly for 5 minutes. First, not 2 minutes, not while you're scrolling your phone, 5 minutes of actual quiet. Feet flat on the floor, back supported, arm resting at heart level on a table. Take 2 readings, 1 to 2 minutes apart, and record both. Do this morning and evening for 7 days before a clinic visit.
The device itself matters. Daniel mentioned ambulatory measurements being regarded as not very accurate, but I think he's talking about those wrist cuff things people buy at the pharmacy.
That's a crucial distinction. The Mayo Clinic is explicit about this. Wrist monitors are less reliable than upper arm cuffs because positioning is so sensitive. The wrist has to be exactly at heart level, and even a small deviation throws off the reading. Finger devices are even worse. A validated upper arm cuff is the only thing worth buying.
There's actually a website, validateepb.org, that maintains a list of monitors that have passed independent accuracy testing. If your device isn't on that list, you're guessing.
Guessing with blood pressure is how people end up either panicking over phantom spikes or missing real problems.
Which brings us to frequency. For someone whose hypertension is stable on medication, what's the minimum that actually gives useful information?
2 to 3 readings per week at consistent times. That's enough to track trends without turning it into a daily ritual that dominates your morning. If you're adjusting medications or you've noticed new symptoms, then bump up to 2 readings morning and evening for 1 to 2 weeks. But the key insight here is that a single high reading is noise. It's the trend over weeks that signal.
This is where people get into trouble psychologically. They take 1 reading, it's high, and suddenly they're convinced the medication stopped working. Then they take it again while anxious, and of course, it's even higher.
The 2-reading rule helps here. If the first reading is elevated, sit quietly for 2 more minutes and take a second one. The second reading is almost always lower and more accurate. I've seen patients spiral over a single 160 systolic that was purely anxiety from the cuff inflating. Wait 2 minutes, try again, and it's 130.
The cuff itself induces a stress response that the cuff then measures. A perfect little Ouroboros of bad data.
That's why variability is actually more informative than any individual number. Your blood pressure is supposed to vary. It goes up when you're stressed, down when you're relaxed. The problem isn't fluctuation. It's a sustained upward drift over weeks.
let's talk about the nocturnal blind spot, because this is where home monitoring genuinely can't replace the Holter. Blood pressure normally dips 10 to 20% during sleep. Some people don't dip at all, and those non-dippers have significantly higher risk of kidney damage and cardiovascular events.
I had a patient years ago. Daytime readings consistently around 125 over 80, well controlled, but his kidney function kept declining and nobody could figure out why. Finally ordered a 24-hour monitor and his nocturnal pressure was 145 over 90. He wasn't dipping at all. His kidneys were getting hammered every single night while he slept.
Without the Holter, that pattern would have remained invisible until the damage was irreversible.
There's a rough proxy you can use at home. Take a reading right before bed and another immediately upon waking, before you get out of bed. If your morning reading is similar to or higher than your evening reading, that's a red flag for non-dipping. It's not diagnostic the way the Holter is, but it's enough to prompt a conversation with your doctor.
Let me pull together the practical recommendations for someone who wants to be vigilant, but not preoccupied. First, get a validated upper arm monitor, validatep.org. Check the list, don't cheap out on the hardware. Second, measure at consistent times, morning before medication and evening before dinner. Third, keep a simple log or use an app that averages your readings and share the averages with your doctor, not every individual number.
Fourth, if you have gout or elevated uric acid, ask your doctor specifically about urate-lowering therapy. Frame it as a kidney and blood pressure question, not just a joint pain question. The evidence we discussed from that 2024 analysis, 5 millimeters of mercury systolic reduction, slower kidney function decline, that's worth a conversation.
The through line here is that monitoring isn't about collecting numbers, it's about spotting patterns. 2 to 3 readings per week, proper technique, consistent timing, that's all the data you need. Everything beyond that is just the cuff messing with your head.
Let me distill this down to 4 things you can actually do with this information.
First one is non-negotiable. If you have hypertension, your kidney health isn't something you get around to checking eventually. Ask for a basic metabolic panel at least once a year, creatinine, EGFR, and uric acid. Not just creatinine, the full picture.
Don't let a normal result lull you into complacency. Kidney disease is silent until it's advanced. By the time creatinine rises on a standard blood test, roughly half your filtration capacity is already gone. Annual labs are your early warning system, not your reassurance that everything's fine.
Second, home monitoring doesn't need to be a daily chore. 2 to 3 times per week, consistent times, proper technique. That's it. More data isn't better data. It's just noise that generates anxiety. You're looking for the trend line, not the individual dots.
Third, and this is the one that gets missed in most hypertension conversations. If you have gout and hypertension, treating the gout aggressively may be a kidney protective move, not just a joint pain move. Urate-lowering therapy with something like allopurinol or febuxostat, that's a conversation worth having with your doctor. Frame it as a kidney question. The 2024 analysis showed roughly 5 millimeters of mercury systolic reduction and slower kidney function decline. That's real.
Fourth, don't fear the 24-hour Holter if your doctor recommends it. Yes, it's one miserable day. Yes, you'll bruise. Yes, you'll want to throw the thing out a window at 3 in the morning. But it catches patterns that home monitoring misses entirely, especially nocturnal hypertension. Sometimes the discomfort buys you information that changes the entire management plan.
The through line across all 4 of these is the same. You're not chasing a perfect number, you're protecting a system. Your blood pressure, your kidneys, and your uric acid levels are in constant conversation with each other. Monitoring just one of them and ignoring the others is like listening to one side of a phone call and assuming you know the whole argument.
Where does this all go from here? I've been watching the wearable blood pressure monitor space with genuine curiosity. Continuous glucose monitors went from diabetic medical devices to mainstream wellness accessories in about 5 years. The same thing might be coming for blood pressure.
Several companies are working on wearable patches that take cuffless readings every 5 to 15 minutes. Optical sensors, pulse transit time analysis. Completely different technology from the inflatable cuff. If those become accurate and affordable, the 24-hour Holter becomes a historical curiosity. One miserable day replaced by a sticker you forget you're wearing.
That would solve the nocturnal hypertension blind spot overnight. Imagine your doctor pulling up a full 24-hour pressure curve from Apache War for a week. No more guessing whether you're a dipper or a non-dipper.
The accuracy question is still open. None of these have full regulatory approval yet, and the physics of measuring pressure without occlusion is hard. But the trajectory is clear. This is coming.
Which brings me to what I think is the real takeaway from this whole conversation. The body doesn't read medical textbooks. It doesn't know that nephrology and cardiology and rheumatology are separate departments. Your blood pressure, your kidneys, your uric acid, they're not three separate problems. They're one system having a continuous argument with itself.
Monitoring one number in isolation misses the system entirely. That's the trap. Someone checks their blood pressure, sees a decent number, and assumes everything's fine while their kidneys are silently losing filtration capacity and their uric acid is creeping upward.
Your blood pressure is a conversation between your heart, your kidneys, and your blood vessels. The goal isn't to win an argument with a single perfect reading. It's to keep the whole system in balance, and to listen well enough to notice when one of the participants starts shouting.
Now, Hilbert's daily fun fact.
In the 1940s, epiphytic ferns in the cloud forests of Papua New Guinea supported an average of 42 individual arthropods per frond, representing over 60 distinct species across a single tree crown.
42 arthropods per frond. That's a lot of tiny tenants.
I'm not sure whether to be impressed or mildly uncomfortable.
This has been My Weird Prompts. Thanks to our producer, Hilbert Flemingtop. If you enjoyed this episode, do us a favor and leave a review wherever you listen. It helps. We'll be back soon with whatever Daniel throws at us next.
This episode's script was written by DeepSeek V4 Pro, with text-to-speech by Chatterbox.
Thanks for listening to our show, My Weird Prompts, where odd thoughts go. From sloth slow takes to facts on cue, we chase the strange and follow through. Some nights it's news, some nights it's lore, a thought you've never heard before. The host dig in, the host dig deep. The stranger the prompt, the less they sleep. From tiny questions, big ones too. From half-formed hunches to deja vu. If something odd is in your head, send it in, we'll chase the thread. My weird prompts, that's the close. From sloth, from man, from long-eared host. My weird prompts, until next time. Stay curious, keep weird in mind.